It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Rachel Campos Duffy.
I'm David Asman, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, March 25th, 2024. I'm Mike Emanuel. Congress avoided a government shutdown at the end of last week, but it wasn't without drama, with Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filing a motion to vacate the chair, seeking to remove House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Instead of being able to persuade others to come along with their ideas and their goals in Congress, they just try to extort the speaker.
I'm Chris Foster. You can't control the weather, and that's contributing to the high cost of home insurance premiums, especially in disaster-prone states like Florida.
It's really something that a lot of Florida residents are dealing with, and it's increasing the cost of housing, making affordability that much more an issue, which, as we all know, is already a huge issue across the country.
And I'm Janice Dean. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
At the end of last week, Russia was hit by a deadly terror attack, killing more than 100 people. ISIS-K has claimed responsibility. And some, like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, are warning its next target could be American interests.
It's deeply regrettable that innocent civilians, women, and children were killed in Moscow, but the next attacks could be against an American embassy in Asia or in Europe, or against, say, students traveling to Europe on a school trip for spring break.
Virginia Democrat Senator Tim Kaine notes the United States tried to help Russia by warning that an attack was coming.
If you want to know the difference between democracies and authoritarians, we will tell nations if we're worried about their civilians. Russia or Iran would never tell us if they had news that there was going to be a terrorist attack in the United States.
The House Republican slim majority is shrinking. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher says he's leaving Congress April 19th. Lawmakers avoided a partial government shutdown this weekend, but drama didn't end there. Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a resolution to vacate the speaker's chair.
Again, I don't have a timeline. That will be a rolling issue that we'll be judging and making decisions by. But I assure you, I'm not the only one. I have support on this from others in my conference. I'm not introducing this to throw the House into chaos. Committees will continue doing their work. Investigations will continue.
If that sounds familiar, it's because similar tactics were used to remove then-House Speaker Kevin McCarthy last October. Congresswoman Greene is taking some heat. Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen says it's a lousy idea.
I think this is a huge mistake. I believe this causes dysfunction in the House when it shouldn't be there. Speaker Johnson's doing the best he could.
The move comes at a pivotal time with voters assessing the strength of Republican leadership heading into the 2024 election.
I'm against it. This is not helpful at all in any way, shape, or form. We're in a bad state right now.
Ohio Republican Congressman Brad Wenstrup is chairman of the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic.
Where people, instead of being able to persuade others to come along with their ideas and their goals in Congress, they just try to extort the speaker. And she's not the first, obviously. And we saw the ousting of Kevin McCarthy. So we're in a challenging time if this is going to be the way that people want to operate. You know, normally you come to Congress, you want to be persuasive. There's things you're working towards. If you don't get it all the first time, you try again. If you get 80% of it, you might take it and then keep working on the other 20. No one likes this appropriations process coming into these minibuses or large omnibus bills. Nobody likes that. And so we have got to stop taking down our own bills and voting against the rule on appropriations bills that are conservative and they're coming out of committee. And Kevin McCarthy tried to put people together that are from the two ends of the Republican Party and on the committee so that when they produce a product, you know, we can all go for it, stand behind it. And when you do these things, it weakens the speaker's hand. I don't like that it comes down to the speaker. I like better when we pass things out of committee, pass them on the floor, and then go to conference with the Senate. But the bottom line is people have to understand that the American government is right now four-dimensional. You've got the House, you've got the Senate, you have the White House, and you have our agencies that we deal with all the time that are regulating things and putting things out there that we try to pass bills to stop them. And I don't think that's what our founders had in mind. So I'm hoping with this bill being passed and on its way that we can then get into 2025 and do the appropriations process appropriately and get things done on behalf of the American people. What I am against is the shutdown. I was here in 2013. I stood by the shutdown and we paid a heavy price for it.
Congressman, you have some legislative proposals yourself, one being the Educate Act, which is seeking to end diversity, equity, and inclusion teachings in medical schools. Tell us about that proposal and what you hope it can achieve.
Well, as you probably know, we have a doctor's caucus in Congress, and I'm one of the co-chairs, along with Dr. Greg Murphy. And we put this forward because we see what's taking place in our alma maters, in our medical schools, and we're moving people along that don't necessarily have the credentials that we normally expect of someone who gets their medical license. And so you would always get there based on your merit. You certainly want to provide opportunities for people that normally wouldn't have them to get into school and to be prepared to get into school. But this is not good for the trust the American people will want to have in their physicians going forward. You're going to have people questioning whether the person in front of them actually really progressed and is qualified for what they are doing, because these people are being put into a position where they normally might fail, but they're being coddled and you're changing things from graded to pass fail. And it's a real danger. Not only that, it's the same in residency programs as well. It needs to be based on merit. You know, we fought for 60 years or more in this country to make sure that we were providing equal opportunity for people and that there was no discrimination. DEI is exactly the opposite of that. And it's dangerous when it comes to your healthcare. And this is not the place you can be doing this. You know, we don't do it in sports, do we? You have to be there based on your merit. And that's sports. Here we're talking about people's lives.
Another bill you've brought forward and that a bipartisan group in Congress is urging President Biden to implement is the No Surprises Act. How would this bill help the American people?
Well, the No Surprises Act was actually written very well in a way that can help the American people tremendously. What happens a lot of times with patients is they go to the hospital in an emergency situation. Maybe even the hospital is in their network, but this is an emergency surgery, for example. And the doctor that was on call to operate on you is not in network. So you would get this large bill that was an unnegotiated rate because they were out of network. Well, what we wanted to do is remove the anxiety from patients and create a situation where doctors would want to be in network and providers of insurance providers would want to get you in network. Mm-hmm. So we take the patients out of it. We have a 30-day period where the doctor and the insurance company could come to an agreement. And if they don't, there's an arbitration process. The arbitration process we wrote up was very fair, so it would not give and tip a hand to one side or the other. And we wanted to make sure that there was no benchmark like a median in-network rate, because the insurance companies can control that. They can remove their high-end providers and drive that down. So we passed a bill that didn't allow that. We made it very clear, bipartisan fashion, out of Ways and Means Committee, across the board, signed by President Trump, and put in place to really help patients through tough times and do something fair for the providers that take call and see patients in these situations. And unfortunately, HHS came out with their ruling and basically said, you can use that as a benchmark. And that has thrown the whole system into flux. There's a huge backlog on arbitration. We were trying to get to a position where you avoid arbitration, and we're trying to fix that.
Just this past Friday, Congressman, Russia was hit by a deadly terror attack that left more than 100 people dead. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. What do you make of the situation and the fact that the United States warned Russia?
Well, you know, that is something that the United States has been doing. If we pick up some intelligence that especially are going to harm innocent people in almost any country in the world, we do want to let them know. And so we let them know, and still this happened. And it surprises me that this could happen in a communist country like Russia, almost said Soviet Union, sorry, like Russia, where they have a pretty good idea who everybody is and coming in and out of their country, as opposed to our country right now, unfortunately. But and then this is ISIS-K that is claiming responsibility. This is the same group that launched the attack on the United States when we were leaving Afghanistan. And now you see all this posturing. One group is claiming that that they did it. And then you have others saying that this was the Russians are saying this was the Ukrainians. I can understand why they want to say that, to inspire their people to be more angry at the Ukrainians and to try and legitimize, I guess, his work in or the war in Ukraine. And I don't think you can legitimize it very well. That's maybe what they're trying to do. And then there's also some that are saying you blame the special forces of Putin. So the accusations are flying across the board, and I think time will tell exactly who did this. But it's always sad when something like this happens. A terrorist attack is a terrorist attack, and they usually occur on innocent people that don't have anything to do with the actions of the government.
Congressman, you lead the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic. What do you believe your subcommittee has accomplished, and when can we expect potentially more public hearings?
Yeah, so we are heading into a phase of having more public hearings, actually, because we've had transcribed interviews with Dr. Ralph Baric, a renowned coronavirologist associated with gain-of-function research. We've had Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, Dr. Daszak, who's head of EcoHealth Alliance, who was doing gain-of-function research on American tax dollars in Wuhan, China. And so next we'll be bringing some of these people forward for open hearings. And as we do that, we'll also be releasing the finally approved transcriptions from the interviews that we've had with them. Look, there is so much for the American people to take in with this. You know, one, why are we even doing gain of function research? And that's where I am right now, because I believe if you want to try and do it to predict the next pandemic, you can probably do that through AI and not actually create a more infectious virus. There was so much obfuscation by China. It's certainly a cover up. They sent me a letter right away saying it's a grave mistake for me to even proceed with it, with this process. And we know what kind of programs they have in Wuhan, and their bioweapons program is certainly a part of it. They've written about it. So a lot of things pointing to something going awry in China, for sure. We may never have all the answers because they're not cooperating, and that's a problem. But in our interview with Dr. Fauci, he never looked at those talking about how it could have come from the lab, never looked at that science. And in our interview, I suggested he might want to look at that. But he did say during his hearing now that it's not a conspiracy theory to say it came from the lab. But what did we endure for, you know, well over a year or 2 years that anybody who said something like that, they were being disregarded and canceled, et cetera. So we made a lot of gains in the things that people probably want to know about. And as you look at the agencies now, when it comes to origins of COVID, the DOE, FBI, CIA, ODNI, they all lean towards lab leak theory.
The chairman of the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic, Congressman Brad Wenstrup, thank you so much for your time, sir. Have a great week.
You too, Mike. Take care.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
I'm Benjamin Hall, Fox News correspondent and New York Times bestselling author. Join me for my brand new podcast, Searching for Heroes. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
This is Janice Dean with your Fox News commentary coming up.
State Farm Insurance announced last year it would stop issuing new homeowners insurance policies in California and announced last week it's dropping coverage for 72,000 homes starting this summer. It blames rising costs, outdated regulations, and more wildfires. It's more hurricanes contributing to the higher insurance prices in Florida. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed bills in December to create a reinsurance fund meant to stabilize the market and to rewrite rules on things like coverage denials and attorney fees.
We have about 8% of the insurance claims for homeowners nationwide. The state represents 78% of all the litigation.
Higher insurance costs are making it harder for people in Florida to afford to stay in their homes and harder for them to sell because buyers are discouraged by the high cost of premiums.
This is a recurrent issue in Florida where the average insurance premium, you know, homeowner is dealing with about $6,000 annually is what it is on average, and some people are paying a lot more.
Katrina Campins is a Fox News and Fox Business real estate contributor and host of Mansion Global on Fox Business.
I myself am paying a lot more. I can attest to that. This figure, you know, surpasses the national average by more than triple and marks a threshold increase compared to Floridians' average insurance cost in 2018. Adding to the strain, several major insurance carriers have departed the state over the past year, leaving residents with limited alternatives, and they don't have options, right? So there's three primary factors that have been contributing to the insurance challenge. Firstly, natural disasters are becoming more frequent and costly. Secondly, the cost of reinsurance is skyrocketing. And lastly, Florida's litigation-friendly environment exacerbates the issue by facilitating easy lawsuits against insurers. Florida has experienced an average of $4 billion disasters annually over the past 5 years. So consequently, insurers struggle to turn a profit or secure reinsurance to safeguard their stakeholders, which brings me to the importance of reinsurance. So insurance companies generate revenue through risk pooling among policyholders and risk reduction via reinsurance. Reinsurance serves as a safety net for insurers, providing financial protection against these events. And all of these natural disasters has created a burden to policyholders. So to navigate these challenges, some companies have opted to limit coverage for specific damages, while others have withdrawn entirely from the state.
The insurance companies have people whose job is to look at this stuff and look at algorithms and math it out. And if you look at XYZ and determine rates based, you know, property values, prevalence of claims, rebuilding costs, and they want to keep profits the same, what's the solution?
Well, you know, Florida has responded proactively to the property insurance crisis by passing Senate Bill 2A in December 2022, which is a comprehensive package of insurance reforms. One significant aspect of this litigation is a rule change aimed at discouraging policyholders from litigating against insurers to recover attorney fees. However, you know, if some of these measures are really debated with concerns over access to justice and escalating litigation costs. So the bill restricts the assignment of benefits, a mechanism enabling third-party entities to negotiate with insurers on behalf of residents. Now, while this mechanism has enhanced the advocacy, it's also contributed to rising claim costs. So Florida's, you know, its actions to address the policy insurance crisis raise a critical question, which is, will the state serve as a model for disaster-prone regions or serve as a cautionary tale? Like states like California, Louisiana, facing similar challenges may draw inspiration from Florida's response, and that response is still in the process. It's really something that a lot of Florida residents are dealing with, and it's increasing the cost of housing, making affordability that much more an issue, which, as we all know, is already a huge issue across the country. So it'll be interesting to see what actually transpires. And I know so many people personally dealing with this issue where they can't get insurance. And I haven't heard of, you know, a remedy per se that has been successful yet. So it's Florida's legislative response reflects our an ongoing effort to strike a balance between providing the opportunities and containing the costs, ensuring fairness and accessibility for insurers and policyholders alike.
Yeah, I imagine that people with very expensive properties have a hard time getting those insured for their true value. And then on the other end, like you said, you're on a fixed income or you've even paid off your home. or you buy a home figuring, okay, I can swing this. This is my mortgage. This is my insurance. These are my taxes. I know the taxes are going to go up a little bit, but otherwise I think I got this. And then suddenly, bam, you're hit with, you know, thousands of dollars more that you just can't afford.
Absolutely. And it's really so sad because Florida used to be, you know, the state that, again, so many people came and retired to, or it was affordable. And, you know, inflation in Miami, where I'm from, is leading the nation. So we were leading the nation in home prices, right? And now we're leading the nation in inflation, you know, and Tampa's right behind that, and just Florida in general. And then property taxes now and insurance costs are really creating a really bad scenario for a lot of people, you know, and the economy, obviously, in its current state is not helping.
Part of the problem here is reinsurance. Talk about how that works and how there may be a legislative fix for it. Are insurance companies legally required to have too much backup?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, reinsurance kind of helps these insurance companies be covered, right, with risk. And they're having a difficult time. It's like a homeowner can't get insurance. Now the insurance companies are having difficulties getting reinsurance. So then that becomes an issue. So a lot of insurance companies are just dropping people altogether. And so there's so many different factors that are going into the insurance issues right now. It's not just about the natural disasters. So as far as the, as you mentioned, the reinsurance, a lot of people aren't aware that insurance companies generate revenue through risk pooling amongst like the policyholders and the risk reduction via the reinsurance. And reinsurance serves as a safety net for insurers. And it provides them with financial protection against these events. So the surge in climate-related disasters has led reinsurers to also hike their premiums, compelling insurers to pass on that burden to policyholders. So it's like a domino effect, if you will. You know, the insurance companies are going to pass those costs on to the homeowners.
There's such thing as the National Flood Insurance Program. Might this be a situation where the federal government at some point, if you still want people to live in Florida and Louisiana and Southern California, might this be a situation where the federal government has to step in and subsidize or nationalize disaster insurance?
Something's got to change. And I think you're absolutely right. Like citizens insurance, you know, sometimes if you can't get, that's an example, if you can't get insured, then ultimately your backup is citizens insurance, which is not, you know, sometimes it's more expensive, sometimes it covers less. So I do think that the government's going to have to get involved if this continues to happen, because what else is the alternative?
Yeah. A couple just fun-ish questions before I let you go. I plan on winning one of these big lottery prizes in the next couple of days. I've got it booked. I want to spend, say, $100 million in cash on a property. Where should I spend it? What should I get?
We just in one property, or are you going to diversify?
You can talk me into it. I want them to be really, really lavish, crazy, over the top.
Well, I'm all about once you have that kind of money, like enjoy quality of life, right? And have diversification. I wouldn't put it all in one property. So I would buy a property in Florida with that much money. You could afford insurance costs, right? Or you just take a chance and don't get it insured and pay cash. I love Tennessee. Tennessee is one of the markets that I absolutely love. Ohio has become so popular recently because the cost there is so low and you could get so much for your money. And the weather's amazing in the summertime. You know, obviously you have the winters, but I would diversify. And I love Montana. That's another market. You know, having filmed Mansion Global all across the nation, the markets that really stick out to me are like Montana, Jackson Hole, Tennessee, Florida. People are relocating to Oklahoma, believe it or not. So you can get a lot of land there. So I would diversify so that you can jump around. I mean, with that much money, you can enjoy all these different lifestyles, right? And not have to worry.
Okay. So I'll buy a half a dozen houses or maybe a couple plots of land. And then that can be my architecture fund building project there. Yeah. Finally, a lot of people like to window shop on the sites like Zillow. It's fun. Are those values based on anything in reality, or is it just for fun?
I wouldn't take Zillow values very seriously. I think they're more approximate, if you will, than actually accurate. The only way to really determine what your property is worth is to have a human actually do a comparable market analysis.
Well, I'm still going to look and flip through the pictures, though.
Yeah, you could still look and have some fun, and you know, but they're not 100% accurate.
Katrina Campins, Fox News, Fox Business Real Estate contributor, host of Mansion Global on Fox Business. Katrina, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on the abortion pill. Mifepristone was first approved by the FDA in 2000 and needed to be prescribed in person over three doctor's visits. Since then, prescriptions can now occur through telemedicine and the drug delivered by mail. The group suing argues the FDA exceeded their authority by making it more easily available. Thursday, the former head of cryptocurrency exchange FTX will be sentenced. Sam Bankman-Fried was convicted on fraud and conspiracy charges, accused of running a Ponzi scheme that stole more than $10 billion from customers, lenders, and investors. Also on Thursday, it's MLB opening day, with all 30 teams slated to play. Friday, Beyoncé releases her first ever country album, Cowboy Carter. The album's singles have already put Queen Bey in the record books, making her the first Black woman to reach the top of the Billboard country charts. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Anna Eliopoulos, Fox News.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. Far too often, women's lives are cut short as they fall victim to unthinkable crimes. But each week this month, I'll be joined by women who fought back, survived, and took back control. You won't want to miss this month's stories of survival, strength, and resilience. Listen and download on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Janice Dean.
What's on your mind?
A few weeks ago, the House Select Subcommittee investigating the coronavirus pandemic issued a subpoena for former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to appear for questioning over his failure to cooperate with a probe into New York State's COVID-19 nursing home policies. As many of you know, I have been fighting for 4 years when it comes to truth and accountability into the deadly decisions that I believe helped kill thousands of seniors in New York in the spring of 2020, including my husband's parents. March 25th is the fourth anniversary of the must-admit directive for nursing homes to accept COVID-positive patients. It was issued by the Cuomo administration and the New York State Health Department. That executive order was in place for 46 days, in which time over 9,000 sick patients were brought into the homes of where our most vulnerable resided. The former governor has never formally been questioned as to why he signed this order that defies all science. And despite all the dire warnings that were issued by experts and even Cuomo himself in the spring of 2020, a subpoena is a start to try to find the truth. And I look forward to hearing him finally go on the record. But there also has to be a thorough after-action review here in New York to make sure this Category 5 disaster never happens again. So far, the only state to release an independent report is New Jersey, conducted by former Assistant State Attorney General Paul Zubik. Like New York, New Jersey also had a similar executive order admitting people who were diagnosed with COVID-19. The report found that these homes, including those that were veterans facilities, were a, quote, profile in incompetence that allowed the virus to spread uncontrollably in the earliest days of the pandemic and kill at least 200 residents. Our current governor, Kathy Hochul, who was Andrew Cuomo's lieutenant governor at the time, told families, including mine, in a closed-door meeting that she wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to our loved ones. And although there have been several reports issued by the Attorney General and the Comptroller here in New York, a few hearings and bill proposals too, we have not seen anything in the way of a thorough top-to-bottom investigation for one of the worst-hit states in the country. Meanwhile, our former disgraced governor has been on a media tour criticizing people in his own party for enforcing laws and decisions he made while in office. He's been appearing on local radio stations, writing newspaper editorials, and doing television interviews about congestion pricing here in New York, the influx of migrants, homelessness, unemployment, and high taxes. The fact that media outlets are helping to rehabilitate his career without challenging him once again is infuriating. It's important. On March 25th, the anniversary of what I believe was a death warrant to thousands of elderly, to remember and remind people of what happened to our loved ones. It was avoidable. And the fact that Andrew Cuomo continues to have a platform without being questioned about the catastrophic decisions that were made during the COVID pandemic is one of the biggest reasons I've been so loud and persistent. And the fact that 4 years later, there is still no justice or accountability for their deaths. And although the headlines have died down about what happened during COVID 4 years ago, and many choose to forget the incredible danger our relatives faced because of those decisions, I will never give up, no matter how long it takes. Because it's up to us, the living, to seek justice for our family members who died and whose memories will always be a blessing. Janice Dean, Fox News.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.